taking in an estimated $43 million. The raunchy animated comedy Sausage Party came in second place, opening in second place, with an estimated $33 million in ticket sales. And in third place, Disney's Pete's Dragon, coming in with $21 million in estimated sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with our guest Peter Damarnoff, asking whether prostitution should be legal. When my wife and I got married, we signed a ketubah, a Jewish wedding contract. It's a beautiful piece of art, and we proudly display it framed in our living room. It has the same text in both English and Hebrew, and it's signed by two witnesses. The ketubah is obviously very meaningful to us. Yet at the same time, it feels odd to me to describe a marriage in terms of a contract. A wedding is not a quid pro quo. We are not agreeing to exchange goods and services. Yes, of course, this was once the case. Marriage is built on a long tradition of consolidating power and wealth. And even now, there are significant economic consequences to getting married. My wife and I hold joint property. There's a specific order of inheritance. We share debt. But these have become secondary reasons for getting married. The primary ones are that we love and are devoted to each other, that we want to build a life together and create a family. We're committed to raising a child and adding to a community that is larger than us. I say all this to distinguish a marriage from a purely economic social relationship that governs our lives, like employer and employee, salesperson and customer, and even teacher and student, to name just a few. These are purely economic because mixing them with the affection, loyalties, and sexuality present in a healthy marriage complicates them immensely and often makes them immoral and sometimes even illegal. So we've come to say that certain human activities are simply not economic at all. Affection and sex are supposed to be independent of money. When they're not, and when we are circumspect about people's economic motives, we discreetly refer to one of the spouses as a gold digger or a trophy wife. But when we are explicit about economic motivations, when we're obvious about it, we no longer talk about intimate relationships at all. We talk about pornography and prostitution. In recent years, we have even coined the term sex worker as an attempt by many to remove the moral stigma of exchanging affection and sex for money. Now, sex work is nothing new, but what qualifies as sex work is vague. The taxi dancers of the first half of the 20th century engaged in purely economic relationships, and so do their modern contemporaries, lap dancers. Both are ostensibly sex-free, but surely the close dancing of taxi dancers, the rubbing of two bodies together while standing, was just as sexual for the soldiers who paid their 10 cents as the less subtle grinding is to those who slip a few bills in strippers' G-strings. We've decided that sex necessarily involves skin-to-skin contact and orgasm, but then again, not always, since many couples fight about whether online flirts or webcams or phone sex qualify as cheating. On today's episode, we're going to pull these strings. We're going to ask about the legality and morality of prostitution. We're going to look at the philosophical foundations of why some countries allow for legal sex work and why some do not. We'll discuss whether it is inherently moral to sell one's body, whether the government ought to play the role of parent, and whether legal sex work's proximity into the indefensible practices of sex trafficking makes it inherently corrupt. We're going to ask whether dire poverty means someone's consent to prostitute him or herself is illegitimate, and whether one's individual rights mean they should be entitled to engage in self-destructive professions. But before we do any of this, we ought to be reflective about the lines we have already drawn. We ought to think again about what should be called sex, whether we can wall away any human activity from commercial exchange, and what American puritanism and general uncomfortableness about discussing sex means for any philosophical analysis about prostitution. Many sex workers will claim that they talk to their customers much more than they have sex with them. They claim that sex work is more about being lonely than it is about needing sexual gratification. We even identify emotional affairs to describe spouses who have not engaged in sexual activity with others, but whose actions affect the intimacy and emotional balance of a marriage. Sex has much more permeable boundaries than most people would like to admit. It need not be touching. It can be a word, a glance, or even a thought. Maybe this is what Jesus was getting at when he claimed that looking at a woman with a lustful eye would already be committing adultery in one's heart. But Jesus wasn't a capitalist. So how would the Sermon on the Mount change if that lustful eye were part of a contract? Is it no longer immoral if the heart's adultery comes for a price? With all these questions in mind, we turn to our guest. Peter DeMarnoff is a professor of philosophy at Arizona State University and the author of the book Liberalism and Prostitution. Peter, welcome to Why.
Thanks, Jack.
We're live this evening. We'd love to have your questions and comments. You can email us at askwhy@und.edu, askwhy@und.edu, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or join our conversation with our new intern, Sam, who's been thrown into the deep end today on his first day, in our chat room at philosophyandpubliclife.org. Also, if you are a Periscope person, we're testing that out too, so you can see me in action. So, Peter, all of that aside, let me get this question out of the way first, because I think it's really important, and I know that many of our listeners are going to be preoccupied with it already. Is our conversation already suspect because we are two men talking about prostitution without any women present at all? Is this a problem?
Well, the topic you announced for the show is, should prostitution be legal? And this is something I've written about as a scholar, the extent to which legal restrictions on prostitution can be morally justified. I think everyone, male or female, should think critically about whether controversial legal restrictions of liberty can be morally justified. So if our conversation today helps someone to think critically about the justifiability of prostitution laws, then that's a good thing.
Isn't there, though, a sense that, I don't know, there was a long period, there's been a period of time for the last couple decades where when the news covers a topic of Spanish interest, suddenly the anchor is a Spanish person. And if there's coverage about some of the horrors involving the African-American shootings by police, it's usually covered by an African-American. There are going to be people who bristle at this conversation, who are going to say that men think differently, critically even, about prostitution than women do. Do you think that that's I don't want to get a conversation about the meaning of critical thinking, but do we need a fully representative conversation in order to have a fair conversation?
Well, one thing I would say is that in writing my book, I tried to read as much as I could about prostitution. And many of the authors I read were women. Some of them took a self-consciously feminist perspective. And in some ways, I feel as though I learned the most from them about what prostitution is like for the people who do it. In the end, when we think about moral issues, we often have to put ourselves in the positions of others whose situations are different. So we have to be able to imagine what it's like to do something that we don't actually do. And we base some of our reasoning and our conclusions on that. I mean, I'll say in my defense, first I'll say, if anyone's bristling listening to me talk about this, then I apologize. I'll try to avoid saying things that make you bristle more. But, my book has been reviewed by men and women, and none of the women reviewers took exception to the fact that I, a male, had written it.
You know, it's an interesting thing because as the host of the show, I've had all sorts of topics that made me really nervous in advance. This actually wasn't one of them. This wasn't something that I thought, oh my God, we're going to step on 1,001 toes. But at the same time, when I announced the topic, particularly on Facebook, people had immediate and gut reactions. I also know that in the feminist literature, there's what appears to be an equal divide between people who think prostitution should be legal and people who think prostitution shouldn't be legal. And so I guess, is there a dominant school of thought about this now, or is it really a topic that's on the table and folks are just trying to make sense of it all?
Yeah, I think that's right. I do not think there is a single feminist position. I think it's exactly as you describe, that some people who identify themselves as feminists are vehemently anti-prostitution. They're anti-prostitution activists, or sometimes called abolitionists. And others who regard themselves as feminists are in favor of what they call full decriminalization. So I don't think there is a distinctive feminist position on this topic. I think it's an issue that divides feminists.
You know, it's interesting that you use the word abolitionist, because we got a question from John in Grand Forks via Twitter, and I was going to wait until we got into the meat of things to ask this, but it ties into the word abolitionist. He asked, if a woman choosing to be a prostitute is like an African-American using the N-word, is there a sense of someone who's becoming a prostitute taking ownership over the slings and arrows or the abuse that might be foisted upon them? Does that comparison, especially given the fact that you're citing someone using the word abolitionist, does that comparison make sense, or do you think it's too far afield?
I think there's something to it. In the 80s, there was a number of prostitute decriminalization advocates met. And they called it, I think it was something like the first Whores Congress, the second Whores Congress. These were working prostitutes who believed that prostitution should be fully decriminalized. They identified themselves as whores, understanding no doubt that that is seen by many as a derogatory term. But they used it, I think, to challenge the assumptions on which it is seen as derogatory.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I have a book that I suspect comes from that, although I didn't know about this, called A Vindication of the Rights of Whores,
right,
which is a play, of course, on Mary Wollstonecraft, A Vindication on the Wife of on the Rights of Women.
Yes.
Does a woman cease to be a woman when she's a whore? Does the term whore eclipse a person's womanhood? Does it eclipse a person's personhood? Or is the argument simply it's a profession, it's something that someone does, and their personhood and their womanhood, or in a case of male prostitutes or transgender prostitutes, does the person continue to be what they were beforehand? I guess, is prostitution a form of compartmentalizing someone's identity?
I think many, on the basis of my reading, I would say that it's true of many prostitutes, sex workers, whichever term you prefer, do compartmentalize. They may see their sex work really as work and not as sex. And they may keep that, at least in their own minds, very separate from the sex they have with their friends, partners, intimate associates in their personal lives. But of course, I mean, I don't think it's easy for people to completely keep those things separate. But I think that it's probably an accurate description of many sex workers that they try, or they view the things as separate.
There are some who would follow that thread and would suggest that, in fact, sex work isn't really about, or hiring a sex worker isn't really about sex, but it's about power. Is that a fairly common attitude, that really this is a form of even exploitation and oppression, that sex is the tool, the way that almost rape can be a tool in warfare?
clients have many different motives for seeking prostitutes. You mentioned a very commonly cited motive, both by clients and sex workers, which is the alleviation of loneliness. So I think you said in your introduction, which, by the way, I thought was very good.
Well, thank you.
That many prostitutes say that they end up talking to their clients more than having sex with them. And that is consistent, certainly, with what I've read. I think many clients go simply for, you might say simply for sexual relief. Even that, I think, is not exactly simple. They may be motivated by depression and anxiety, or some of them may get off on just the sort of excitement of the pursuit, or the doing something wrong, doing something taboo. On the basis of what I've read, I would say that some do seek out prostitutes in order to feel power over somebody. They may enjoy humiliating the prostitute or doing things that are perceived as humiliating in order to affirm a sense of control and power. I mean, sex is complicated. Human motivation is complicated. People seek out sex workers for all sorts of reasons. They can have more than one motive at the same time. So it could be power, sex, and alleviation of loneliness all at the same time.
I know that you're a political philosopher by trade, and in the second half of the show, we're going to talk more from a political philosophy perspective, but you mentioned these different motivations. Do you think that the morality and therefore possibly the legality of prostitution ought to change based on that motive? For example, it might be okay to seek out a prostitute if you are trying to alleviate your loneliness, but if you want to assert dominance in an oppressive way, then perhaps that shouldn't be permitted. Should we micromanage sex work in that sense, based on motivations, based on intent?
So there are a lot of different issues here. One is, a topic that philosophers talk about, moral permissibility. What is morally permissible? Sometimes we think that actions are morally permissible that are not ideal. So we think that it's morally permissible, even in non-commercial intimate relationships. It could be morally permissible for someone to terminate a relationship, even if. Their actions are open to some sort of criticism. That is, we don't want to say that it's impermissible for them to do it, but we might still have doubts about the basis on which they did it, or the way in which they did it, or the timing, or whatever. So it's complicated. I mean, you think of a complicated issue like divorce. Is it morally permissible? Yes. Is it always the right thing to do? No. It's we use the term morally permissible and ideal sometimes interchangeably. It's sometimes hard to keep them apart. In the case of prostitution, personally, having thought about it a little bit, I can't think of any reason to think that the exchange of sex for money is categorically or unconditionally wrong. That is, wrong under any conceivable circumstances. I can't see any reason to think that that offering somebody money in exchange for sex is categorically or unconditionally wrong, or wrong in every circumstance. Does that mean that it's a good thing, or ideal, or advisable, or usually a good thing? No, it doesn't mean that. It could often be a decision or an action which is open to question, open to some sort of criticism, even though it's not categorically or unconditionally impermissible.
And so let me explain just that to our listeners, because obviously categorical is a huge word in ethical theory. But basically what you're saying, and what, again, will qualify, pull some more threads in the second half of the show, is you're suggesting that you cannot imagine a blanket prohibition, that in every instance this is wrong, in every single instance this is morally permissible, but you will, and you do in your book, navigate that minefield and say, well, here are some circumstances in which it probably shouldn't be legal, and here are some instances in which the harm is so large that it is impermissible. So while you can't necessarily say it's absolutely wrong, you're also not saying that it's absolutely right.
Correct.
So is it possible to define the boundaries of what constitutes sex work? And I'm alluding to part of what I said in the monologue, but also to this, to the sense that if someone wants to kiss someone on the lips and says, I'll give you $20 if you let me just kiss you for a second, does that constitute sex work? Is sex work, or is sex in the eye of the beholder, and therefore the people who are engaged in the exchange have to sort of decide for themselves what it is they're doing and what they want to call it?
Yeah, I actually, a colleague at Rutgers Law School, his name is Stuart Green, and he recently sent me something that he wrote on trying to define sex work, and he made a convincing case that it's very difficult to define it in a completely satisfactory way. A lot of things are like that, obviously. Love being something else, intimacy being something else. There are a lot of terms we have a rough handle on. As far as the law goes, any proper law is going to have to be pretty specific about exactly what is permitted or not permitted. But I'm not sure that it's possible to come up with a definition that perfectly captures all the sort of subtle distinctions that we make in our moral thinking.
It makes me think of that episode of Seinfeld, an example that may be passé at this point, but that an episode of Seinfeld where they're trying to define sex, and for a variety of reasons they say that sex starts when you see another person's nipple.
Right? Yeah, right. But, yeah.
And so if you are reluctant to offer, or you find it incredibly difficult to offer a definition, doesn't this run in the face of what philosophy tries to do, right? Doesn't philosophy try to, at least certain branches of philosophy, try to define and analyze and divide and categorize so that we can create a litmus test for whether something meets ethical standards or not? Is it hard to be a philosopher and to come up to the conclusion that says, look, this isn't something that you really can define. It's something that you have to parse and accept nuance and allow for wiggle room.
Well, the great 20th century Austrian philosopher Wittgenstein made this point about games. He said that even though we use the term game in ordinary language, it's actually not possible to identify necessary and sufficient conditions to give an analytical definition of a game. The things we call games are very varied, and so what they have they don't all have a single property in common. Or it's not true that there's a property that all and only games have. So that means you cannot come up with a perfect analytical definition of the term game. What you can do for the sake of clarity in a philosophical discussion, you can do this in framing laws too, is give a stipulative definition. Say, well, by sex work, I will mean such and such, and then that promotes clarity. Even if it's not possible to give an analytical definition that perfectly captures our intuitions, which are based on the way we ordinarily use the term.
When we come back, we're going to talk about a variety of factors. We're going to talk about paternalism and whether the government has the right to make us do things that are best for us. We're going to talk about individual rights, and we're going to talk about this thorny issue of consent, whether a person in dire circumstances can be said to be consenting to prostitution. Because this, of course, it's also a huge issue, and someone, Ashley from Fargo, asked about the definition of willing, the definition of consent. So think about those, and when we get back, we'll dive right back in. You're listening to Peter DeMarnoff and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back in a moment.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Every Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Peter Demarnoff, asking the question, should prostitution be legal? And two stories come to mind. Both took place in Amsterdam. The first, my father went to a conference for the first time in the city. And Amsterdam famously has a red light district where the prostitutes sit in windows and sell themselves to people walking by. And often they're full of tourists. And my father was asking directions to one place, and the people who ran the conference gave him directions, and he found himself walking through the red light district. And then later on, he asked directions to a different place, and he found himself walking through the red light district. And then he asked for several different other places, and he always found himself walking through. And so he went to the conference organizers, and he said, how come every direction you give me ends up having me walk through the red light district? And they said, well, we know that all of the Americans want to see it and they're embarrassed to ask, so we just send them that way. A few years later, I was at a version of the same conference, actually with him, and I ended up meeting a Brazilian woman, and she and I went walking around, and we saw the red light district, and we were talking, and she, it turned out, was Catholic, and self-identified as Catholic, although I don't know what that meant for her per se, other than participating in Brazilian Catholicism. And I told her that, you know, wow, it depresses me, I see this, it makes me unhappy, what a horrible life these people had. And she looked at me sort of puzzled, and she said, it seems a lot less horrible than many other jobs that women have to have. And this struck me, coming from a woman, coming from a self-defined Catholic, as sort of shocking. And so what these two experiences lead me, Peter, to want to ask you is, how much of attitudes about prostitution is about culture and attitudes about sexuality, and how much is it about political philosophy and ideology? In other words, are the Dutch, are the Swedes, are Austrians and Germans, places where prostitution is legalized, is it because they just are more relaxed about sex, or do they hold to a particular ideology that is independent of whether or not families are comfortable having conversations about sex with their kids?
Well,
I know that's a hard question, but
my knowledge is limited. I've read a fair amount about this topic. I don't believe that the attitudes towards prostitution in Germany or the Netherlands, where prostitution is legal, are very different from the attitudes of most people in the U.S. So, for example, I think that most parents in Germany and the Netherlands would be unhappy if their daughter started working as a prostitute. They'd be anxious if their son started dating a prostitute. There are a lot of negative attitudes that people have towards prostitution. And what the basis of those attitudes is obviously a deep question. But I think what the Germans and the Dutch do is they separate the question of personal morality, whether this is ideal, whether this is something you would encourage anyone you care about to do, that's one sort of question, from the question of what the best government policy is. And I think they've concluded for various reasons that the best policy, all things considered, is a policy of legalization, some form of legalization. I actually think that's perfectly consistent with thinking that it is regrettable or unadvisable or even in wrong in some more general sense, like not ideal or fails to respect the human capacity for intimacy properly. I think it's possible to think it's wrong in that way and still think it should be legal. So I wouldn't take the relatively liberal legal policies of Germany and the Netherlands and some other places to indicate a fundamental difference in attitude towards the activity itself.
So it makes me think of needle exchange program. No one is happy that people are using heroin, but having a needle exchange program might be good government policy and certainly good health policy.
Exactly.
So I want to, in just a second, I want to ask you about government moralism and neutrality and liberalism. But we got an interesting question via email from Joyce in New York. And she asks, did the author ask prostitutes who are not literate or academics what they think? And I guess what she's asking in essence is, I know that there's Holocaust testimonies and there's slave testimonies. Is there a literature of either through one's own authorship or through interviews, is there a literature of sex worker testimonies and prostitute testimonies? And when you investigated this issue, how much did you take into account the people who might otherwise have been forgotten or might not have a very articulate voice, but who have either been sought out by anthropologists, by health workers, by other folks? How much did you get the voices of non-academics and actual prostitutes, and how much do you think that that influenced your critical thinking about it?
Well, there's a substantial literature, I guess you could, ethnographic literature, based on interviews, questionnaires, and other things by sociologists, where they really do try to represent the voices of sex workers, and I believe that I relied on that that evidence fairly heavily. Now, what you find is that sex workers, especially ex-sex workers, have very different attitudes towards it. That is, there just as there isn't a single feminist position on prostitution, there's not a single prostitute position or sex worker position on prostitution, on what the law should be. So some sex workers say that it's just like any other job, and it's better than some of their alternatives. Others say that it's a horrible experience that has permanently scarred them, and so you get this—you get a really sharp split within the testimony itself. So, as somebody who's looking at it, you have to, you know, you draw your best to draw, you know, you try your best to draw reasonable conclusions. I suppose the conclusion that I've drawn that is supported, I think, by what I've read, is that there's no single experience. There's no single experience of being a prostitute. It's not always bad. Sometimes it is an advisable choice for people. Other times it's a very bad experience, and it's a very regrettable choice. And so there isn't really a single sex worker voice. There's not a single sex worker experience.
And if I understand the major conclusion of your book, your claim is that this is ultimately not an ideological question, but an empirical question. The question is about the real harm towards real people and certain kinds of prostitution, let's say working in a brothel, is tremendously harmful and therefore should be outlawed. But other forms of prostitution may be significantly less harmful, and therefore there are circumstances in which it's permitted to be legal. Is that a fair description of your ultimate conclusion?
I'd put it slightly differently. Okay. I would say that that on the basis of, again, on the basis of what I read, it's a bad experience for many people. For various reasons, it seems like a bad choice for most young people to make. It seems like it's a choice that commonly leaves people worse off in the long run. And therefore, that as a society, we should be concerned with young people entering this work, to potentially to their lasting detriment. And therefore, it's a legitimate concern of government to try to shape opportunities, incentives in such a way that young people will not make that choice, or it will be more difficult for them to make, while at the same time allowing older people who have made a mature and informed decision that this is their best choice given their alternatives, the liberty to make that choice. So I want to say that prostitution is problematic. It does seem like it can be psychologically damaging and damaging in other ways, and therefore we ought to try to protect people, and especially when they're young, try to adopt policies that will result in fewer young people going into it, while at the same time respecting the liberty of mature adults.
So this makes me think, I wish I could remember the exact words, but this makes me think of Bill Clinton's comments about abortion, where he basically said abortion should be legal, safe, and rare,
yeah.
right? And that this is the same sort of thing, that prostitution should be legal, safe, and rare. And so I wanted to be clear about your conclusion, because I want to go through some of the objections and the different themes that you pull, that you analyze in the book, including both Ashley from Fargo asks and Joyce from New York again asks about the nature of consent. If someone is in such dire straits that they have to end up being a prostitute, can we fairly say that they are consenting at all? Aren't people pushed into a corner and therefore no one willingly becomes a prostitute?
Well, so the notion of consent is very complex, and it's problematic, and it's sort of philosophically contested ground. And I'll try to simply just isolate two different questions. One question we might make of an action is it voluntary? Now, normally I would say that if somebody deliberately decides to do something without anyone threatening them, you know, like having a gun at their head, and they understand the nature of their act, then they're doing it voluntarily. I think that the available evidence strongly supports the conclusion that the vast majority of prostitution is voluntary in that limited sense.
Okay, let me stop you just right there for a second, because I think that's an important point. So if someone is listening to this conversation and saying, well, but what about sex trafficking? What about sex trafficking, especially in North Dakota right now in the oil fields? This has been a topic of great concern because the rise in sex trafficking has been exponential and terrifying. And lots of us know stories, either first or secondhand, of people who have been forced into prostitution. You're suggesting that the evidence suggests that the vast majority of prostitution would not fit under the category of sex trafficking, but it would be voluntary in the sense that no one has a gun to someone's head and the person is willingly choosing to do it with some sense of what they're getting into, even if it's not a complete sense. Is that fair?
That is fair. I would add that the term sex trafficking is also a contested ground, and there's kind of a political pull and push over this. So those who are in favor of full decriminalization, Amnesty International a year ago came out in favor of that policy, they want to make a very sharp distinction between prostitution on the one hand, or sex work as they call it, and trafficking. Now, what they mean by trafficking is prostitution that results from force or fraud. That is, that results from somebody either threatening you with a weapon or a bodily harm, or defrauding you in some way through a deceit or some other illegal activity like stealing your passport. So that's one thing. Then they want to say, well, that's a problem, but that's only a very small minority of sex workers who are the victims of trafficking in that sense. But in this country, there are a number of anti-trafficking organizations that intentionally blur the distinction between prostitution that results from force or fraud on the one hand and all prostitution on the grounds it's sort of rhetoric. They say prostitution is never a choice. So they are inclined to present all prostitutes, all streetwalkers, or at least the vast majority, as being sex trafficking victims. So when the issue of sex trafficking, say, comes up around the Super Bowl, or you're talking about the oil fields in North Dakota, anti-prostitution activists often use the term sex trafficking to refer to all prostitution, even prostitution that is voluntary in the narrow sense that I just explained.
And this, of course, for the purists back home, this notion of voluntary has a long history from Thomas Hobbes on, where Thomas Hobbes thought that everything was voluntary unless someone is physically moving your body. And then, of course, the existentialists are going to have a very different definition of voluntary in terms of informed consent and adopting an ethical standard. And so By talking about voluntary, again, we're talking about someone who is choosing, who has a certain amount of agency. But then someone's going to counter and say, and this is a line that I've heard many people say, no little girl grows up dreaming that she will be a prostitute, right? No one wants to grow up and be a prostitute. And so in that sense, right, what does it mean when people suggest that or let's say, is it coherent to suggest that a willing person is consenting or a willing person is volunteering to do it, but they're not really consenting because if they had full information, they would never agree to do this?
Well, yeah. Let me take your question in a slightly different direction, picking up on something you asked earlier, but it's connected to everything we've been talking about. So one of the reasons why consent is a sort of a contested concept, and there's a lot of debate about it, is because we assume that if someone consents to something, that if A consents to do something with B, then B is not open to any sort of criticism. So we might talk about two consenting adults deciding to have sex. And the idea is, well, if both people fully consented, then even if one person is unhappy with the outcome or their feelings are hurt or disappointed or something, then it was still permissible for the other person to do whatever the first person consented to. Now, we don't think that that's always true. So we don't generally think that the fact that a minor says to an adult, yes, I willingly do that, protects the adult from moral criticism or legal liability. So part of the issue of consent is separate from the issue of whether the action was voluntary. A 14-year-old can voluntarily have sex with a 19-year-old or a 25-year-old or 35-year-old. The question is whether we take that consent as shielding the adult, as it were, from any sort of criticism or liability.
Let me interrupt you a second, because again, this is incredibly complicated, and let me see if I can articulate what I think you're saying. Voluntary is about a person's action and choice as an individual. So a 13-year-old can voluntarily engage in sex with a 25-year-old. But there's a legal meaning to the word of consent, or a moral meaning to the word of consent, in which consent means that the person who is participating is protected from criticism, from moral critique, even from legal ramification. So in other words, we can say a 13-year-old can volunteer to do something, but a 13-year-old can't consent to do something because she or he doesn't meet the legal standards or the moral standards that we set up in order to say, yes, that's enough. And so the 25-year-old can do anything he or she wants as long as the 13-year-old volunteers. Does that make
sense? Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
So we're talking about almost a psychological and a physical agency. I can volunteer to do something, but consent is a much more complicated legal, moral term. And so public policy ought largely to be more about consent than voluntariness?
Okay. Well, we have to decide. So, I mean, presumably the reason we have laws against statutory rape is because we believe that young people are vulnerable to certain kinds of manipulation by older people, and older people using them in certain ways that are not in the best interest of the young people, and the young people not having adequate understanding or ways of resisting that manipulation. So we adopt that consent standard in order to protect young people from certain kinds of harm. Even if we acknowledge that psychologically, yes, they can voluntarily engage in sex with an adult, we say we're not going to take that that agreement as sort of legitimating the transaction. And we might do that with this is now happening, of course, with adults. There's a lot of discussion now about when does sexual assault occur. And it's, you know, many people argue that if the person is inebriated, then they can't consent. Well, they can consent. Unless they're unconscious, they can consent. They can say yes. They can say okay. But we might say, that doesn't legitimate the interaction because they're inebriated. So we have to make a decision about what sort of level of protection we should impose by determining when we will take some sort of verbal agreement or some sort of action to legitimate the transaction. Yeah, that's a moral and legal question.
And so this goes back to that question of when can a government be paternalistic, or when can a government take responsibility for protecting its citizen? The government may or may not hold an opinion on a person's individual morals or the voluntary nature, but a government can define what consent is and therefore restrict and punish people based on that definition.
Yeah. And then the question is where exactly should that line be drawn? So in an issue like sexual assault, it's very complicated. You don't necessarily want to say that whenever somebody has a blood alcohol level above a certain amount that they can't consent, because that would mean that people who are in committed intimate relationships are committing sexual assault against each other every time, say they drink, have two or, you know, more than two or three drinks an hour. Well, you don't want to say that. But on the other hand, you do want a legal standard that protects people from the harm of unwanted sexual advances. But it's very complicated. It's very tricky.
And how does this connect to the claim that some people will make that say, if I can't sell my body or if I can't buy sex, then you are violating my individual rights? Does this consent notion relate to what you call the civil libertarian argument that look, individual rights are primary in this country, and if I want to sell my body or to buy someone's body for an hour, I should have that right?
So there are a number of different issues here. One is, do people have a right to sell sex? Another is, do people have a right to buy sex? Another is, do people have a right to operate sex businesses as third parties, like a brothel or something like that? And I think that each of these questions, I think these are different issues and they need to be considered separately. The general sort of orientation I have in the book is that individual liberty is very important, that we do need to respect the rights of individuals. And that does put certain sorts of constraints on the kinds of prostitution law that can be morally justified. But it's not because the government is not legitimately concerned with the harm that prostitution can do. So I'm trying to find a kind of middle ground where we say, yes, we do have to respect the rights and the autonomy of adults, but we also have to be worried about this practice, which seems to be harmful to many people.
So we're just about out of time. Is there any last summary statement that you would suggest that you would offer people, how they can think critically and how they can start again thinking about the attitude of prostitution to come up with a clear position for themselves? What's the last word?
So the main point that I make in the book and is that, as I say, there are these three different issues and they should be separated. So when we talk about the legalization of prostitution, we're actually talking about many different things. Should the sale of sex be decriminalized? Personally, I think the answer to that question is yes. I think that people have a right to control their own body, and that laws that criminalize the sale of sex violate that right. Does it follow that brothels should be legalized? Not at all. No one needs to operate a brothel in order to control their own body. So those are two entirely separate issues. Should purchase be legal? That's more complicated, and that depends more on a number of empirical questions that are hard to settle. But the main takeaway, I'd say, is it's important not to lump all these things together, and that it's possible to coherently believe that although individuals have a right to sell sex, that doesn't mean that prostitution is not a legitimate object of government concern or the government shouldn't do anything to try to discourage it.
So, Peter, I want to step back for a second and remind the audience that you're a political philosopher and that you're writing in the context of this thing called liberalism. Can you tell us just briefly what liberalism is and why the question of prostitution is so relevant to this particular political philosophical approach?
Well, the term liberalism is used in different ways. For one thing, it's used in different ways by liberals and conservatives. So, by liberals, it's used as a term of praise, and by conservatives as a term of condemnation. But when I talk about liberalism, I'm really not talking about liberalism as the term is used in public political discourse. I'm talking about a certain kind of political theory. And the essence of this political theory is that people have rights to liberty, and that because they have these rights, certain kinds of reason cannot justify the government in restricting our liberty. And so to be a liberal in the sense that I'm using is to be committed to an idea of individual rights, and not only to be committed to that idea in the abstract, but also committed to certain substantive claims about rights to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, sexual and reproductive freedom, freedom of movement, freedom from slavery, freedom, political liberty, freedom to vote, participate in politics. So liberalism is a substantive view about rights. And so what I was interested in the book is to what extent can prostitution laws be justified consistent with taking the individual rights seriously.
And so just to help folks for who these terms are new, in the American system, both mainstream Democrats and mainstream Republicans are liberal because we believe that there are rights that are endowed by our creator, that we are all endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights, among these rights, life, liberty, and happiness. And that perhaps one candidate in the current election aside, every candidate in the last 100 years, if not longer, would identify themselves as a liberal. And so since we as a society value individual rights, any question that does X violate our individual rights? Does making marijuana illegal violate our individual rights? Does not letting us use certain music on YouTube? Does forcing us to go to school? Does making us take medication even against our religious views? All of these are questions that are fair game in a liberal scheme because we're asking about individual rights, and prostitution is one of those questions on the list. Does prohibiting prostitution violate our rights? That is, on its very face, a question for liberalism.
Yes, exactly.
And so then someone can come along and say, okay, but that's a fairly literalist interpretation of individual rights. Couldn't we also say, does letting someone become a prostitute violate her individual rights because it legalizes victimization? Is that another school of thought?
Well, yeah. Okay. So that's a very, so I guess we'd have to focus on what it means to let somebody become a prostitute.
I would say legally.
Right? Legally. So again, I'm assuming that some people engage in actually the vast majority of sex workers do the work voluntarily, and that many of them do it. They're not coerced. They sincerely think it's the best choice for them. So in my view, they should be at liberty, the adults should be at liberty to do it. And if the society prohibits them from doing that with the threat of criminal penalties, then it's violating that individual's right to control their own body. Now, of course, as I was saying earlier, I think we as a society have an obligation to protect people who are vulnerable and even to protect them by deterring them from making self-destructive choices. And I think this is a choice that is self-destructive in many cases. And so I think that if the society were to do nothing to protect vulnerable young people from being drawn into this, then I don't know if I'd say that the society is violating their rights, but I would say that the society is not living up to its obligations.
So let me ask you to consider a comparison and see where this goes. I mentioned the oil fields in North Dakota, and you did as well. And the death rate in the oil fields is very, very high. And oil rigs, the injury rate is huge. People lose limbs. People get brain injuries. People breathe in all sorts of toxic chemicals. People tend to go into the oil business because they don't have a lot of choice and because they're economically in a corner, to use a phrase I used earlier. Is the difference between becoming an oil worker and becoming a prostitute one of just the likelihood of damage? A prostitute is much more likely perhaps to be raped than someone is to lose a limb, or much more likely to get HIV than someone is to get lung cancer or something like that. Is it just a matter of quantitative difference, or is there something about bodily integrity, about sexual activity, that makes the choice that someone in poverty has to make to work on an oil rig fundamentally different than someone who's in poverty who has to work as a prostitute? Is it a quantitative difference, or is it a qualitative difference because of the nature of the body and sex?
I think it's a qualitative difference in two ways. One is that the kind of harm that sex workers suffer, and again, I mean, this is according to certain accounts,
sure,
is psychological, has to do the feelings that the experience can give rise to in terms of their attitudes to themselves, self-respect, self-esteem, their ability to have healthy relationships with other people, the opportunities they have to have healthy relationships with other people are all impacted by prostitution in a way that working in an oil field presumably does not impact a person. So it's a different kind of harm. Now, that doesn't fully address the question. You might still say, well, but don't we allow adults to undertake occupations that are risky in various ways, and are the risks of prostitution really worse? And that's a good question. That's a complicated question. We also have to factor in at some point, though, the costs of prohibition. So it may be, I mean, if you think, well, we might have a law that would prohibit working in an oil field, of course, that would have a huge negative impact on our economy and our standard of living. So if you're going to compare these two things, you have to take all the factors into account. But yes, I would say that on the basis of what I've read, the negative psychological and social impact of working as a prostitute is different in kind from working, from what I understand, working as an oil worker.
And I don't want to get into, and here's an inside baseball comment, I don't want to get into casuistry here, but I have a list when I was thinking about the show of different kinds of prostitutes, of people who identify themselves as escorts, but also as dominatrixes and people who work in massage parlors and all this stuff. And one would imagine that different types of prostitutes would risk different kinds of psychological damage. And I've heard interviews with people who identify as dominatrixes who say, well, they are entirely in control. Their clients are go to them to be hit or whipped or humiliated, and there's actual no, let's say, no intercourse, no skin-to-skin contact, yet we call that person a sex worker. Is this kind of sex work less damaging and therefore more permissible, or is the psychological consequence of being a sex worker in general, because of the cultural attitudes, because of the role of sex in the human experience, is it all part and parcel of the same thing, albeit one is more extreme than the other?
So I would, I think, again, you know, on the basis of what I've read, that there are really no valid generalizations in any area. So discussions typically make a sharp distinction between the so-called high-class call girl and the streetwalker. Well, I mean, I'm inclined to think that for some, the experience of streetwalking is actually okay, and it's their best alternative under the circumstances, and that for some, being a high-priced call girl is horrific.
That's right. Julia Roberts seemed perfectly fine and pretty well.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, another point, sometimes it's not understood that the boundaries between these things are tend to be fluid. And so that it's not uncommon for someone to be to work at a brothel at one point in their career, work out of their home at another point, work on the street at another point. So it's not, I mean, these lines are somewhat artificial. But I guess I wouldn't feel comfortable confidently stating that any kind of sex work in this sense is always bad or always horrific, or that any kind is okay. I think that, I mean, that being a dominatrix, as you've described, that's very different because it doesn't involve skin-to-skin contact, and the dominatrix is in a very different position. But I can imagine that some people might find those interactions extremely upsetting. And so I don't think we could just say, well, that's harmless. I mean, there's so many differences, and the individual people involved are so different, and their clients are so different, that it's hard to feel confident making any generalizations like that.
Going back to sort of your political framework, you make the distinction between a group of people that you call civil libertarians and a group of people that you call progressives or progressivism. So civil libertarians, we've talked a bit about, they're folks who are primarily concerned with individual rights, and they want the legality, they want prostitution to be legal to protect this individual rights notion, to keep it as pure as possible, although I know that's a loaded term. What's the progressive position? What's the alternative position here?
So these, in a way, yes, they were my terms. I use them as labels. It's somewhat idiosyncratic. What I had in mind by civil libertarianism is a certain view about justifiable government restrictions of liberty. According to which the only justification for limiting someone's liberty is to protect someone else's rights. And so you say, well, the people should be at liberty to do what they want unless they are violating someone else's rights or exposing them to a very high risk of immediate harm, something like that. Progressivism, as I understand it, holds that the government is legitimately concerned with protecting people's health and safety, and in general, raising or levels of welfare in various ways, fostering human welfare, increasing it in certain ways, and sometimes by that goal, justified in restricting liberty, even when the exercise of the liberty does not involve a direct violation of someone else's rights. To give you just a very simple example that few people would disagree with, we think about highway safety and traffic laws. The things that we do that put ourselves and others at risk often do not actually constitute rights violations. And yet, safety is promoted by having certain restrictions on speed limits, traffic signals, and so forth and so on. And so the idea is that it's not true that the only legitimate function of government is to protect our rights from being violated. It's a legitimate function of government to increase our welfare in other ways.
Right. I was thinking about this again when I was preparing for the show. Grand Forks is on the border between North Dakota and Minnesota, and North Dakota does not have a helmet law for motorcyclists, and Minnesota does. And so you often see people riding without helmets, stopping at the border, putting on their helmets, and going on. And there's a debate amongst the states as to whether or not a helmet law is a legitimate role for the government. Is that an overstep that people have the right to smash their head like a pumpkin if they want? Or rather, the government can say, no, the personal cost, the social cost, the medical cost, the political cost is too high. And so even that notion is divided. And so I guess I want to ask, and I will apologize in advance because this is a massive question going back from Plato onwards. Does the government have a role to make people better? Is perfectionism, is the idea that the government should make its citizens better people, wiser, more virtuous in a religiously neutral sense of virtue, is that a legitimate notion of government? And if so, how would that affect the debate? And if not, how would that affect the debate?
Well, the way I look at it is that we have, as individuals, interests. There are reasons that we have to want things. And some of those things that we have reason to want involve our development as people, and so involve being better in some general sense. For example, we have interests in education, and we assume that in some sense a person is better off if they're educated, that they have these capacities, these mental capacities, and that education exercises and develops these capacities, and that's a good thing. And so I think education is a legitimate goal, goal or function of government to create opportunities for education. And not just book learning, but in terms of sports and the arts, all these things have to do with developing people. So I think that people do have interests and opportunities to develop, and the government rightfully tries to create opportunities like that. When you talk more about the specific issue of virtue and vice and perfection, I think it's very hard to talk in general about that. We have to look at particular claims and particular policies. Do I think that the government is justified in prohibiting prostitution because fornication is a vice? No, I do not. But that's a very specific question. It's not this sort of general question about does the government have any role to play in making people better. We have to look at particularly the kind of betterness that's being claimed and also the particular policy.
So with that in mind, and this may only be a transition in my head, but I'm curious about the move that many people make that, okay, selling sex is not necessarily wrong, or selling sex should not necessarily be punished, but buying sex is. And so the prostitute is not immoral. The prostitute is in a bad circumstance. The prostitute is doing what he or she needs to do. But the John should be punished. The John should be discouraged, because then we are punishing, criticizing, attacking the person who was creating the demand, as opposed to victimizing or punishing the victim. How do you feel about the moral distinction between the seller and the buyer and focusing on the John rather than the prostitute?
Yeah, so there's two different questions. There's the moral question, and then there's the legal question. So Sweden has the policy, and now Norway, I guess, has it too. France, I think, is considering it. I don't know if they've actually adopted it. But there are no criminal penalties for selling sex, but there are criminal penalties for buying sex. Now, the rationale for that policy is not that buying sex is wrong, whereas selling sex is not wrong. The rationale is that prostitution is harmful and the penalties for purchase will depress demand and therefore will protect, will reduce the harm. So that's really a, so that's sort of a non-moralistic argument. There, but you could also ask if one is wrong, isn't the other one also wrong? It's hard for me to, I guess I don't think either is, as I said earlier, unconditionally or categorically wrong. So, and I think that there, I think that somebody who said that the sale is never wrong, but the purchase always is, I think they'd have a lot of explaining to do. I find that a hard position to understand myself.
The long-term listeners will know that I am an Adam Smith scholar, and so this sort of notion of exchange is very interesting to me. And so given that background, I can hear the shouts in my head when I ask the following question. Couldn't someone say that being a John, purchasing sex, is inherently taking advantage of someone's desperation? Isn't you know, a person who becomes a prostitute because of largely negative circumstances? I'm sure there are counterexamples, but let's assume largely negative circumstances. And that a John who does that is taking people at their worst circumstance, in their worst situation, at their weakest, and profiting sexually from that. Is that a... In that case, it would be a moral condemnation. Does that make sense in your way of thinking about prostitution, or is that too moralistic for the government to legitimately make that claim?
It makes perfect sense to me. So the idea of exploitation makes perfect sense, that you're taking advantage of someone's weakness in a way that benefits you and leaves them worse off. That idea makes perfect sense to me, and I think that often is true in prostitution and is morally objectionable. I agree with you. The only thing I would resist is the inference that therefore buying sex is always wrong or unconditionally wrong or categorically wrong. And we can, I think it can help us to imagine circumstances in which it might be okay. There was a movie that came out a few years ago called The Sessions, set in the 70s or 80s in Berkeley, starring I think John Hawkes and Helen Hunt. And it was about a man who, as a result of polio, had to spend his life on an iron lung, and as a result had never had sex. And so he found out about a sex therapist, someone who had sex as a profession with somebody for therapeutic psychological reasons of psychological health. And the portrayal in the movie the way that the relationship is portrayed in the movie, the woman has control. She's not desperate. It's a respectful relationship. It's hard for me to see anything morally wrong with that transaction, but it is an exchange of sex for money. And it was very important to the sex therapist character that was understood, that was a limit on the relationship. So I don't think it's possible. I've not been able to find a plausible explanation of why exchange of sex for money is inherently wrong or unconditionally wrong. Is it often exploitive and abusive? Yes. In those cases, it's wrong.
And so we're back at the core of liberal theory, which is really the central questions are the questions of whether or not the agents are being dealt with respectfully and with dignity. That prostitution that has a certain core element of respect and a certain core element of dignity is morally permissible, not legally, but morally permissible under the liberal ideology, and notions that and prostitution that violates people's respect and violates people's dignity is impermissible. But in the non-ideal sense, in non-ideal political theory, because we can't necessarily expect all people to act under those two terms or those two ideas, we have this other standard, safe, rare, and legal, that the reality is people are going to become prostitutes. The reality is sometimes people need to become prostitutes, and we want to discourage it, but we want to protect it when it happens.
That seems right to me.
Well, that is an excellent place to end. Thank you, Peter, so much for joining us, for taking us on this journey through liberalism as well as this complicated notion of prostitution. I admire the discipline in which you deal with the subject, but also I admire the forthright nature, way in which you can talk about something that makes people so uncomfortable. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Jack. I've really enjoyed it.
We will be back with Why Radio right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions of Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking with Peter Demarnoff about prostitution, about its legality and morality, its relationship to culture, and its relationship to political philosophy. As always, we've chosen an incredibly complex topic, but also an emotionally laden one. None of us wants to see people at their most desperate. None of us wants to see people exploited. But at the same time, we also want to protect people's individual rights and people's ability to get out of bad situations, should they need to. And that small group of people who enjoy prostituting themselves, enjoy being escorts or perhaps sex therapists, as Peter suggested in a later example, maybe they should have the space to do what they want. And so we have to offer compromises and nuances and suggest that, well, brothels are fundamentally exploitative, but putting out your shingle may not be. What then are the criteria for moral and legal prostitution? Well, we find ourselves facing a standard that we first encountered several decades ago when Bill Clinton was talking about abortion. We want prostitution to be safe, legal, and rare. We want to discourage our children from becoming prostitutes. We probably want to discourage young people from using prostitutes. But once people make the decision, we want to protect them, and we want to make sure that they're healthy, that they can get out when they need to get out or want to get out, and that they are safe when they're engaged in the activity. Because at the end, all of this is built on the idea that a liberal democracy, that a country that protects people's personhood, that protects people's individual rights, is based on the idea that we protect people's dignity and that we respect one another. Is there a way to engage prostitutes respectfully and recognizing their dignity? There are people who will say no. There are people who will say that using someone else's body is never respecting them. But there are others who say that we can. It's not assaulting them. It's not abusing them. It's respecting their consent as well as their voluntariness. But ultimately, the question before us is, can we create a system of prostitution that respects personhood? Someone like Immanuel Kant said we couldn't, but Peter Demarnoff suggests that maybe we can, and even those instances when we fall short, it doesn't mean we don't have responsibility towards others. We always have to protect those who are the least among us. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.